You may be seated. Next matter before us is Hugo Alberto Sandoval versus Commonwealth. Jacob.
Did the council sign their sheets?
Counsel, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
I would ask to reserve 3 minutes.
All right. We're delighted to hear from you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Matt Biro, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Hugo Sandoval. There are 4 issues in this appeal. I think the biggest one and the one I'd like to address first is the due process issue. Basically, there's always some sort of clock that is running on the prosecution. And after an indictment comes down, the speedy trial clock starts to run, and I think that's the one most people are most familiar with. But before an indictment comes down, the due process clause, amongst all the other things that it does.
But where is the prosecutorial misconduct, the bad faith that is required?
I think that misconduct would be the wrong word. You know, Morissette laid out 2 things that I need to establish. It's my burden. One is prejudice to the defendant, and the second thing is a tactical advantage to the prosecution, and I think that that is what I need to establish, as that the prosecutor is trying to obtain a tactical advantage, and I think there's 3. And the other thing is, the 2 things about that is, one, I think that most things that prejudice the defendant are of a tactical advantage to the prosecutor. So I think that, you know, Morissette says they're like 2 different
Can I interrupt
elements.
You for a second? The Morissette, as you know, and as you've briefed it, has many cases interpreting it. And the language that implies the negative connotation is the improper purpose language. It is not improper for you or for a prosecutor or any lawyer to seek a tactical advantage. Half of litigation is doing exactly that. It's doing it improperly. It's doing it with bad faith. It's doing it in a way that is outside the norm. It's doing it in a way that's manipulative. It's doing it in a way that obviously the rules of the statutes don't contemplate. So I question whether your starting premise is right, which is, no, it's, if they get a tactical advantage at all, you satisfy that second prong. But I think that's what you just said.
That is what I would argue. I would argue it's just tactical advantage. But to show the bad faith, I think one of the best examples of bad faith in this case involves the sexually violent predator evaluation that was done. Which, as the court knows, at the end of Mr. Sandoval's sentence, because he was coming up on the end of his sentence before this second round of indictments came down, Dr. Alona Gravers went in and did a sexually violent predator evaluation of him.
Didn't hear the trial court say that I'm aware of it, but I didn't read it. It had no impact on what I was doing.
The trial court and the trial court, I think the prosecutor said that, and I would argue it doesn't matter, because whether the Attorney General's office, who does all the civil commitments of sexually violent predators, and Alex Iden, the Commonwealth's attorney for the city of Winchester, both have the same client, which is the state of Virginia. And I think whether or not he read it, the state of Virginia was doing that to Mr. Sandoval.
But there's no prejudice if it didn't affect the judge, right?
Well, so going back to prejudice and tactical advantage, I think you need to look at the case as a whole, and when you're trying to evaluate whether there's been prejudice to the defendant and a tactical advantage, you should look at pretrial proceedings, you should look at the trial phase, and you should look at the sentencing phase. And at the sentencing phase in this case, the prosecutor had the same evaluator do the 19.2-300 evaluation, which can be asked for before sentencing. He had when the case started, I'm never going to use that sexually violent predator evaluation. And then at the sentencing phase, he has the same psychologist do the 19.2-300 evaluation. And what does she use when she's doing it? She uses the sexually violent predator evaluation. She's already done.
Is this improper motivation or improper purpose review a question of law or a question of fact?
Oh, I think it's mixed. I mean, I think you've got to look
at... Well, it's mixed because Morissette sets out the standard, but the determination as to whether or not the prosecutor got a technical, a tactical advantage or not, has to be a question of fact to be resolved by the circumstances presented to the trial judge. And unless we can make a determination that the trial judge abused his discretion or whatever as far as the review of those facts, aren't we stuck with that determination, similar to basically a Brady violation or something like that?
Okay. Well, here are some other things that I would argue are facts about this case. And one, I think the prosecutor concedes. I think the three main things
you should first answer Judge Alston's question. If there are predicate facts that need to be determined, don't we defer to the trial judge? And if your case turns on basically those predicate facts, don't we have a very high standard of review? Or a low standard of high deference review?
If the court rules that way, yes. I guess I would argue that maybe this is more a question of law. Although there are, I think it's a mixed standard. So I think that's all I have to say about that question. But I think some of the other things the court should consider are the Mason case. Okay, and in looking at tactical advantage and prejudice, the co-defendant was tried and convicted back in 2005. And back then, Mason hadn't been decided, which is the case that says that the unit of prosecution for child pornography is every picture or video or what have you. And back then,
we realized we recently decided a few months ago that every second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh picture is a subsequent offense.
Yes. Yeah, yes. There's been, I think, several decisions from this court that reiterate the same thing. But if you're a prosecutor back then, and you're engaging in plea negotiations, what do prosecutors do? They run the guidelines. And they're like, well, here are the guidelines. I'm going to make an offer in the guidelines. And back then, the defense attorney in the plea negotiations phase would have said, you know, you're saying that every picture is a separate offense, but there's no case law establishing that. And so in the plea negotiation phase back in 2004, when all this happened and when he was first charged, the prosecutor didn't have that advantage that he has in 2012.
What's improper about that? The prosecutor says, you know what, the state of the law is unclear, so I'm going to put this prosecution on hold until the courts, which have the duty to interpret the law, tell us what the right answer is, and then I'll reinstate it. If I win, I win. I lose, I lose. What's arguably improper about that?
What's improper about that is he should just prosecute it and get it done. In this case, it's severely disadvantaged the defendant. And in addition, you know, I think when you're looking at this, you should just
ask. Well, that's only because Mason came out the way it came out. If Mason come out the other way, it would have been very much to the benefit of the defendant.
It would have been.
So everyone takes risks when we wait on the courts to tell us what the answer is. So do we, actually.
In addition to that, I think he admits in his brief that he didn't want to retry the case four times. And it's an ugly fact, but the victim in 2012 is 22 years old. And I think if you're a prosecutor, you'd much rather have a victim that's 22 years old.
But doesn't that get into us sort of assessing prosecutorial discretion, which I'm not aware of any cases where we actually get into making a determination other than the Morissette line of cases
I would agree. It's a strange line of cases because the court is kind of looking at whether the prosecutor acted, as the court said, improperly or to obtain. I still think it comes down to whether they're trying to obtain a tactical advantage.
But doesn't that get into, and again, it's like this is all theoretical, I guess, but doesn't it get into whether or not a prosecutor should go forward on a case that's considered a cold case? Oftentimes, prosecutors have evidence that suggests or makes somebody a suspect in the case, but they make a determination, we're not going to prosecute now because we just don't have enough evidence to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt, so we're going to hold. And then 5 years later, 10 years later, they get a DNA hit that suggests now we've got forensic evidence to support our theory of prosecution, so now we're going to go forward. If we took your theory, you are suggesting, I'm not suggesting you're doing anything wrong here, that the prosecutor should have gone forward even before this DNA came out because they should have prosecuted the case more expeditiously.
No, because if you look at all, I'm not saying that, because if you look at all these cases like Lovasco and you look at Morissette, in all of these cases, the court held that the pre-indictment delay was fine. And in all of those cases were exactly what you're talking about, They were all cases where more investigation was needed before they brought the first round of indictments. And what I think is different about this case is that they charge him, and the case gets set for a jury trial, and they try the co-defendant's case separately. And then they're like, you know what? We've tried her case, yours is set for trial, but we're gonna null pros this. And then they wait 6 years until the psychologist has evaluated him, and the Mason case law has come down, and their victim's gotten older, and then they're like, now we're gonna recharge you. But
there was no witness the defendant wanted to call but couldn't. There was no evidence the defendant wanted to present but couldn't. There was no document that had been lost in the interim. The average person would look at your argument and say, you know, too bad, you know, but nothing, there was no real prejudice to your presentation of the case.
I would concede, you know, we didn't lose any evidence. The evidence was almost exclusively the phone calls. I mean, I'll concede we didn't, and that's why what I'm arguing is when you're looking at prejudice and you're looking at tactical advantage, you shouldn't just look at the trial phase. You need to look at pretrial proceedings, negotiations, and you need to look at the sentencing phase, because I would argue the sexually violent predator evaluation, it's like gold for a prosecutor. I mean, if I were a prosecutor, I'd much rather, if you set the due process, I think you should just ask yourself a question. Hypothetically, just set the due process clause aside, and would you rather be prosecuting this case in 2004 as a prosecutor with the information available to you, or would you rather be prosecuting it in 2012? And I think most people would say, well, I'd much rather have the case in 2012 because I've got this case law.
But the question is whether the United States Constitution says that the prosecutor can do that. I mean, the answer to your question is yes. But that's not why we're having this argument.
I think if you answer yes to my question and you'd rather be prosecuting in 2012, then I've carried my burden. Because if you want to be the prosecutor in 2012, it's because you got a better case. And why do you have
a better case? So prosecutors wanting a better case are litigating for improper motive?
In this particular, you know, if the court rules for me here, this is going to be real limited. There's not a lot of cases I've ever seen where they charge somebody, they null pros it, they wait 6 years, and then they charge them again. Really, all the court, I think the practical result of the court ruling for me today would just be to say, hey, prosecutors, you know, once you charge somebody, you should try to carry through with it. Or if you're going to null pro, most of the time a prosecutor null process something, they recharge them right away. Within like, it's like the next grand jury. They don't wait 6 years until they've got all this additional information.
It seems you basically are saying that it is not right to eventually be charged and convicted of the crimes that you committed, because sometime in the past, the Commonwealth decided not to push those cases, that you kind of got a deal, and the Commonwealth has to put up or be barred in the future from doing anything, everything, at the time it convicts on one of these related cases. And that your real claim of prejudice is the man who was charged with these offenses eventually was tried and convicted of them.
I think in this case, what was done shouldn't have happened. And really, the sexually violent predator evaluation, I feel like, is a big part of it, because the whole point of that process is to treat people who we have decided are mentally ill. And what the Commonwealth did in this case was they came in, they had a psychologist talk to him. He made statements about what he had done in the past. And the psychologist was like, whoa, this guy is super dangerous. He is a sexually violent predator and he is likely to reoffend. And then the state was like, here's 24 new indictments for this stuff we null pros 6 years ago. And that happens after he gets evaluated in a process, the result of which is supposed to be to treat him. You know, and
the process is meant to get to the truth. Treatment is an issue later to be determined. But you're not really suggesting that any of this is not pushing us to the truth, what actually happened, which fundamentally is the point of a court system.
But there's also a lot of procedural safeguards. And I think all of the things that the prosecutor had in this case just normally aren't available to a prosecutor and shouldn't be. I don't think that we want to have a process where we're doing these civil commitments, and then we're going back and looking through everything that they say and charging people for everything.
But even under the civil commitments, civil predatory, sexual predatory statute, there are limitations as to this information that can be used and for what purposes it can be used.
Well, I think the prosecutor here used it strongly to benefit his case, both at the plea negotiation phase and at the sentencing. I really think it had a big impact. I don't think, you can't tell me that a judge didn't take into consideration the fact that this guy had been evaluated, diagnosed as a pedophile, and as someone who was likely to reoffend.
Into your rebuttal. You can keep on, but...
I will stop at this point. Thank you.
Fair enough. Thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. May it please the court, there are a lot of angles to this case, but I submit that there's a direct, simple, and frankly, most appropriate in terms of an appellate treatment of the case that just quickly disposes of this. And in that regard, it's important to note that the appellant, which the appellant can't do in an appeal, conspicuously ignores several inconvenient facts. First, this defendant was already serving an 11-year sentence for other similar type crimes against these two poor stepdaughters. He wasn't out on the street. The defendant himself admits on brief that the Commonwealth was happy on his sentence, about his sentence. So that's the starting point in all this, that this man was already serving significant time. And I think the defendant does not dispute the fact that the Commonwealth was concerned for the victim, this particular victim in this case, LM, and the possibility she might have to testify as much as four times in the event that there were two trials and then they both were reversed on appeal. Now, the defense attorney, I think, today has correctly acknowledged that under Morissette, he has to satisfy two elements. It's like the Strickland test for ineffective counsel. You satisfy one, but not the other, you lose. And in Morissette, specifically, it said that to sustain this kind of due process claim, defendant must establish that, quote, one, the prosecutor, not somebody else connected with the government in some other sphere, the prosecutor intentionally delayed indicting the defendant to gain a tactical advantage, and two, the defendant incurred actual prejudice as a result of the delay, not as a result of some attenuated set of circumstances years later. Now, it could not be any clearer when it talks about the prosecutor intentionally delaying. That's an issue of intent. That is a factual issue. The trial court's resolution of that is a factual finding, and if it's fairly supported by the record, it's enforceable on appeal, and the Supreme Court of Virginia's recent decision in Commonwealth versus Herring bears that out. That in that case, this court had reversed four abduction convictions for lack of sufficient proof that the defendant intended to deprive the four family member victims of their personal liberty. The Supreme Court reversed, saying it was an issue of fact, and there was evidence in the record to fairly support the trial court's finding that there was the requisite intent. So this is very similar to that. The trial judge here quite plainly found as fact that the Commonwealth had not engaged in some improper or corrupt tactical maneuvering. And there's basically nothing to challenge that trial court's factual finding here or the reasons in support of that factual conclusion. I think that alone means this appellant loses this appeal.
Well, he loses assignment of error one.
He loses on this issue, which by his description is the main issue in the case and the only one he's argued today. And that's certainly true that we have separate issues. But the Commonwealth said quite plainly on the record, both in its memorandum, written memorandum, and in oral argument on the motion to dismiss on due process grounds, that but for certain events that occurred in 2011 and 2012, it would not have reindicted the defendant. I mean, the record makes clear here when the charges were not crossed in 2006 that the Commonwealth had every expectation that that would be the matter, the end of the matter, that there was not, it was not like they were holding the Nopros charges as a club over the defendant's head. The Commonwealth had every expectation that would be the end of that immediate matter, because this man was already serving an 11-year sentence. But in 2011, the Commonwealth received a report that the second stepdaughter had somehow been called by the defendant who made threatening remarks to her. The investigation did not expressly confirm that that had happened, but I don't think there's indication that it expressly showed it was false. And in any event, it certainly went to a concern about what might lie ahead for family members with this corrupt defendant. Second, the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office in the, one of those 2 years wrote to say they understood that this defendant's term on the other sentence was coming to an end, and they were investigating the forcible rape of a six-year-old in California back in 2002. And then finally, the victim in the case that we're directly concerned with, LM, had advised the Commonwealth that this defendant had written her, to put it mildly, an unsolicited communication, and saying he always loved her, and he signed it Poppy, which is a bit problematical because that was the nickname that he used with her. It just, under the circumstances, it was highly inappropriate and again was suggestive of some concern. So the prosecutor stated quite plainly that it was those intervening circumstances, none of which were known to him at the time of the Nopros, that brought about the re-indictment. The trial court found as fact, in effect, that was true. The defendant, the appellant, has not presented any evidence whatever to say that that is, that that finding is not plainly supported by the record, and patently it was. In the Commonwealth's view, that's the end of this issue. But let me add several other points here. The Commonwealth, again, primarily in terms of the Nopros, was motivated by two things. One, the man was already serving a significant sentence, and two, the Commonwealth was concerned about the welfare of the victim, who at that time was 13, and an entirely understandable concern. And as I say, he did wanted to avoid the specter of this victim having to testify as much as four times to these grotesque facts involving her own mother and stepfather. And it's worth quoting two or three sentences from the Lovasco opinion. This is at page 793. The opinion, this is not precisely the same context as what we're concerned with, but it's still suggestive. It says, it's talking about why it would be out of place or ill-advised to require a prosecutor, the moment he has evidence that arguably shows proof beyond a reasonable doubt, to just say, okay, we're going forward, or we have to go forward as a constitutional imperative. And in the course of describing why such a rule might have many ill-advised consequences, the court said, in other cases, the prosecutor would be able to obtain additional indictments despite an early prosecution, but the necessary result would be multiple trials involving a single set of facts. Such trials place needless burdens on defendants, law enforcement officials, and courts, end quote. Well, it also places needless burdens on a 13-year-old victims. Then further on to page 794, quote, finally requiring the government to make charging decisions immediately upon assembling evidence sufficient to establish guilt would preclude the government from giving full consideration to the desirability of not prosecuting in particular cases. The decision to file criminal charges with the awesome consequences it entails requires consideration of a wide range of factors in addition to the strength of the government's case in order to determine whether prosecution would be in the public interest. So what the prosecutor did here was entirely in keeping with what the U.S. Supreme Court in Lovasco indicated were salutary policy considerations. Sometimes the decision not to prosecute is consistent with principles of judicial economy. Sometimes it's the merciful, decent thing to do.
In theory, if we were to say you have to prosecute when you're even halfway there, there'd be a lot more prosecutions for fear that something the day after the Nopros would show that, man, you blew that one.
And in a way, more to the point, it would fly in the face of the second half of the Lovasco opinion, where they just catalog the reasons why that's a bad.
But you're not suggesting that this prosecutorial discretion is unfettered, are you?
No, but it has to be, as I think some of Judge Kelsey's questions indicated in the initial argument, it has to be for some corrupt, improper, tactical consideration. It's not merely trying to, it's a little bit like you hear the word prejudicial. This testimony was prejudicial to the defendant. Well, one would hope that it would be. I mean, what's the point of putting it on otherwise? But there's a difference between improper, undue prejudice and prejudice that follows from the fact you're guilty and now here's proof of it. Same principle here. So when the attorney today, the defense counsel says, what's improper, Judge Kelsey said, what was improper about waiting for the ruling in Mason? And counsel said, what's improper is the Commonwealth should just prosecute it and get it done. If you read Lovasco, that answer just can't be squared with the express reasoning of that court. So there's no question here that there was no corrupt motivation underlying the Commonwealth's decision to null pros. I mean, I don't see, just as a matter of logic, how events unknown to the prosecutor that didn't even occur until 5 or 6 years later, including this evaluation of this defendant as a possible sexually violent predator, how can these things that were unknown shed any light whatever on what was the Commonwealth's intent in null prosing the case? And by the way, counsel talks so much about this report. Again, we're concerned with pre-indictment delay. The report was done in August of 2012. It was submitted in September of 2012. He was indicted in November of 2012. So even if somehow this report assumed the significance that I think it plainly lacks in this case, there was no particular delay in indicting him after it was done. And again, the prosecutor said explicitly, I think at least twice, he'd not even read the report. He said that as recently as sentencing, and he and the judge both said, I don't see any way. He said, I don't see how it's admissible. I'm not going to introduce it. And the judge said, I don't see how it's admissible. So it's a total non-issue. It's a red herring in terms of this due process claim. I think also, briefly, on the issue of possible prejudice, again, if the court agrees with me that the defendant did not satisfy the first of the two elements in Morissette about the Commonwealth's intentional maneuvering for improper tactical reasons, that's the end of this issue. But even just on the prejudice issue, I think he plainly loses, because the defense counsel admitted at trial the obvious fact that this was not an issue of lost evidence, lost witnesses. The evidence was overwhelming. It was unchanged. The same evidence that could have been adduced back in 2005 or 2006, depending when the trial went forward, was the same evidence that, in fact, was put on at the trial in 2013, which, by the way, means the Commonwealth had no motivation, no need to play games. This man was going to be convicted. I mean, it was about a slam dunk of prosecution, as you could imagine. So the Commonwealth had no incentive to play games. Again, I think any prejudice has to be something that is pretty directly linked to the prosecutor's actions. I mean, because, again, in Morissette, it talked about the second element, the defendant incurred actual prejudice as a result of the delay. I think the fact, for example, that in 2007, the statutes regarding these offenses were, in some respects, toughened is far too attenuated. I mean, if somehow the General Assembly had said, well, we're aware of that case in Winchester, and we think, based on that, we're going to strengthen the laws, then it might be a tenable claim. But those are just totally unrelated, discrete circumstances. The same thing with the report in 2012, which was initiated by the Attorney General. Again, Morissette talked about the prosecutor. The prosecutor is the Commonwealth Attorney in Winchester in this case. It's not the Attorney General in Richmond. They are separate entities. So I think that the record plainly shows that the defendant could not and cannot meet either of the two elements in Morissette. Lovasco talked about the due process had some limited role in all this, pre-indictment matters, the main source of protection being statute of limitations. There was nothing here that offended fundamental sense of fair play, nothing remotely along those lines. On the other three issues, unless the court has any questions, I would rely on my brief. And if the court has no additional questions, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Counsel, you have half a minute, approximately.
Very briefly, I would just point out to the court in the transcript where the court, in talking about the sexually violent predator evaluation, the prosecutor says on page 233 of the appendix, I do not intend to use it. And then he asks for a 19.2-300 evaluation, which is the same thing. All a 19.2-300 evaluation is a sexually violent predator evaluation by another name. If the court looks at some, they're the same. And I'd rely on my brief for the rest of my arguments. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll greet the two of you and then take up the Winslow versus Commonwealth case. Okay.